Hello and welcome to Sonnetcast, William Shakespeare's sonnets recited, revealed, and relived. I am Sebastian Michael, and this is Sonnet 80. Oh, how I faint when I of you do write, knowing a better sprit doth use your name, and in the praise thereof spends all his might to make me tongue-tied speaking of your fame. But since your worth, wide as the ocean is, the humble as the proudest sail doth bear, my saucy bark, inferior far to his, on your broad main doth wilfully appear. Your shallowest help will hold me up afloat, whilst he upon your soundless deep doth ride, or being wrecked, I am a worthless boat. He of tall building and of goodly pride. Then if he thrive and I be cast away, the worst was this, my love was my decay. With his amazingly brazen sonnet 80, William Shakespeare metaphorically pushes the boat out in more sense than one and comes close to mocking not only his rival but also, albeit gently, his young lover, whom he insinuates being drawn to this other writer not merely by his compelling poetry, but by a prowess of an altogether more physical nature too. The poem, for all its theatricality on the one hand and its finely layered wit on the other, still ends on a pensive, even melancholy, and for this quite devastating note of self-awareness. Before we look into this further, though, what does Sonnet 80 actually mean? Oh, how I faint when I of you do write, knowing a better sprit doth use your name. Oh, how I grow weak or feeble, or how I decline when I write of you in the knowledge that a better poet uses your name. Even if we accept, as we must, that faint in Shakespeare's day had these subtler meanings than our contemporary lose consciousness, the exclamatory construction of these opening lines still draws attention to itself, setting this poem up as decidedly different in tone to the two previous ones. But the turn of phrase, use your name, continues the transactional or utilitarian subtext of Sonnet 79, suggesting here that this other poet, this supposedly better spirit, not only dedicates his poetry to you or writes poetry for you, but that he does so in pursuit of or in return for some sort of payment, compensation or favour. Spirit here, as every so often in these sonnets, is pronounced with one syllable, sprit. And in the praise thereof spends all his might to make me tongue-tied, speaking of your fame. And in praising this, your name, he spends all his powers to make me tongue-tied, as I speak of your great qualities, worth, and therefore fame. The way this sentence is phrased, again, draws attention to itself. We would expect the other poet to spend all his might in the pursuit of praising the young man, or speaking of the young man's fame, or doing whatever he is doing with respect directly to the young man and for his sake alone. And for all we know, that may well be what this rival poet is actually doing. But Shakespeare places this in relation to himself. He makes it sound as if the rival poet's intention was to make him, Shakespeare, tongue-tied when he tries to speak of the young man's fame. This too, in a wordsmith of Shakespeare's dexterity, can hardly be a mistake. He further deliberately undermines the validity of his sonnet at face value and seems to suggest yet more strongly that we need to look for, if not ulterior motives, then certainly ulterior or secondary meaning. Now, the use of the word fame here, incidentally, lends weight to our contention that the young man is a person of note. Fame in Shakespeare's day does not necessarily have quite the same meaning of being famous as it does to us, but even if we read it more generically as reputation, then it still implies that the young man has a reputation in his world to start with. Also, of course, the fact alone that another poet is writing to, for, and about him makes it clear, if that were still necessary, that this young man is not a nobody. But since your worth, wide as the ocean is, the humble as the proudest sail doth bear, but since your worth, which is as wide and therefore large and seemingly limitless as the ocean, is able or willing or both to bear the humble boat just as it bears the proudest ship. In Shakespeare's day, of course, virtually all seafaring was done with sailing vessels, the exceptions perhaps being rowing vessels, and here he sets out to compare his own modest offering to the metaphorically proud sail of his rival. It is an image that he will use to similarly suggestive effect in Sonnet 86, though its suggestiveness here lies not so much in these couple of lines, but in what follows. My saucy bark, inferior far to his, on your broad main doth wilfully appear. Shakespeare cranks up the, by now surely at least slightly sarcastic contrast, my presumptuous, indecorous little boat, which is far inferior to his immense ship, obstinately or stubbornly appears on the open sea of your being. A bark is simply a small boat, but the adjective saucy, paired with the adverb willfully, lends this small boat, which stands as a metaphor for Shakespeare himself here, a deliberately and playfully disrespectful character. Saucy in contemporary English means sexually suggestive in a light-hearted and humorous way, as Oxford Languages has it, and although this was not so strongly the case in Elizabethan England, Shakespeare uses the word often and often in a sexual or sexually charged context. And it seems more than likely that he is at least aware of the fact that willfully puns on his name. What he also puns on, be that intentionally or not, is the bark of a dog. That's mixing metaphors, of course, but he is here referring to his writing and, if it is intentional, then most likely this specific poem, as the yapping of a loyal but powerless creature that is beholden to his master for survival. Main as a noun, the way it is used here, in early modern English simply means the open sea. Your shallowest help will hold me up afloat, whilst he upon your soundless deep doth ride. Your most modest, even by implication, most meagre assistance will keep me afloat and going, whilst he can benefit from the unfathomable depths of your munificence. This comparison continues to cast Shakespeare as the tiny boat that has to sail on the margins of the sheer boundless sea that is the young man's worth, staying in the shallow waters and sufficing himself with even the slightest nod of appreciation or the paltriest contribution to his upkeep, while the rival, being this amazing vessel with its majestic masts, can venture far into the deep waters where the riches and therefore the returns are infinitely greater. The use of the word ride, once again, is eye-catching because unusual. The only other instance in the entirety of his collected works where Shakespeare uses it in a naval sense of riding a boat is in Sonnet 137, where, as we shall see when we come to it, it carries very strong sexual undertones. Everywhere else in Shakespeare, ride is used either metaphorically or, much more often, literally to mean riding a horse. Or, being wrecked, I am a worthless boat, he of tall building and of goodly pride. Or if it goes as far as me being shipwrecked, because in these shallow waters to which I am confined, I run aground, or because the possibly implied turbulence of your unsteady and at times tempestuous sea throws me against a rock, I am then a worthless boat, whilst he, out in the open sea of your bounteous being, remains what he is, of a tall build and a proud, strong appearance. The last time we came across pride in these sonnets was in Sonnet 76, where we noted its implication in the context there of ostentation and showiness. And this very likely here is also partly intended. Before then, though, in Sonnet 52, we identified strong and obvious sexual connotations with the word pride as well, and having set such a subversive tone to this sonnet, we cannot entirely get away from the sense that Shakespeare here is punning and putting into our minds the idea of a strong, well-built man who is endowed with more than just an impressive upright metre. Then if he thrive and I be cast away, the worst was this, my love was my decay. And so, if it is or will be the case that he thrives on your rich, yielding sea, and I am cast away as a shipwreck on an island of inconsequence and despair, then the worst aspect to this, the most terrible thing about it all, is that it was my love, as in my love for you, or equally it was you, my love, that caused my ruin. The way the sentence is structured allows for a secondary reading also of the worst that will then have happened, as in answer to the question, what's the worst that can happen, will be that it was my love for you, or you my love, that caused my ruin. But considering the severity of the situation overall for Shakespeare, this latter interpretation to me sounds somewhat less likely and rather less satisfactory. Still, which of these two possible, similar but subtly and significantly different endings Shakespeare means to suggest, we cannot know for certain. Quite possibly, he once more, as so often, knows what he is doing with words and means to suggest or offer both readings at the same time. The first striking thing to note about Sonnet 80, before anything else really, is that it addresses the person it is talking to as you. The person it is talking to is the same person as Sonnets 78 and 79 are talking to. Virtually nobody seriously doubts this, and in no reasonable universe would it make sense to assume that Shakespeare suddenly is writing to another person who also, just like the first one, happens to have allowed a rival poet into his orbit in exactly the same way. That, surely, would be a coincidence way too far. Sonnets 78 and 79, however, are addressing their immediate primary reader or listener as thou. We have, then, here, proof positive that Shakespeare switches from thou to you within sonnets that belong together with the same person being addressed, using the two forms of address interchangeably, even though they communicate a subtly but decidedly different stance of the speaker-writer in relation to the listener-reader. Shakespeare will soon switch back again. Sonnets 80 and 81 are both kept in the more formal you, but sonnet 82 then reverts to thou briefly before, with the remaining sonnets in the rival poet series, sonnets 83, 84, 85 and 86, he then sticks with you. Why Shakespeare decides to move from thou to you here, we don't know. He gives no direct explanation. But you may recall that on a previous occasion when he did so, in fact on the first occasion in our whole series, we ventured that he may be doing it so as to signal a certain degree of deference at the time when he was at risk of overstepping a mark. I should emphasize again here that this is speculation, and we cannot know whether this is what Shakespeare intends, but when he switched from thou to you in the procreation sequence, which also incidentally is as good as certain to all of it be addressed to the same young man, he does so when he first calls the young man love. I will not now go over the more detailed reasons as to why this is a significant step, since that's discussed in the episode on Sonnet 13, which of course you'll find wherever you're listening to this episode. But there too, he then briefly reverts to thou with Sonnet 14 before deploying you in Sonnets 15 and 16, sticking with it until Sonnet 17. Now, Sonnets 15 and 16, you may also recall, are the first two sonnets in which Shakespeare is, as we called it then, being saucy, in the sense we saw it defined just a moment ago. Not quite bawdy, but almost. He there goes out on a limb and makes comments on and to the young man that lend themselves more than anything that has gone before to being understood sexually. After that, and into the main body of the Fair Youth sonnets, Shakespeare stays with thou, except for sonnet 19, in which he addresses not the young man, but time, three sonnets, 21, 25, and 33, in which he addresses nobody in particular, but talks about his love, and sonnet 23, which he addresses directly to his young lover, but without referring to him. The next time he then uses you is in Sonnet 52, and what happens there? He is being suggestive. So suggestive, in fact, that we thought at the time it was the clearest indication we had got so far that his relationship with the young man had by then acquired a sexual dimension. And this applies here too. It doesn't, lest I give the impression it did, apply every time he uses you, but it applies here, which does nothing so much as help us segue into this second, though by no means less significant, eye-catching aspect to Sonnet 80, its near but not quite salaciousness paired with a healthy lashing of sarcasm. Shakespeare is rarely overly sarcastic. The last time we got a strong sense of him pulling that register was in Sonnets 57 and 58, also addressed to you, also somewhat suggestive of the young man's sexual licentiousness. There was one milder, less convincing instance in Sonnet 72 where we couldn't be quite sure. Here now, though, it is hard to take Shakespeare entirely at face value. There are many, many of these sonnets that have a simple sincerity which doesn't change no matter how you read them. Give Sonnet 80 a bit of thespian oomph and you are instantly in the land of comedic make-believe. Oh, how I faint when I of you do write. knowing a better sprit doth use your name, and in the praise thereof spends all his might to make me tongue-tied speaking of your fame. But since your worth wide as the ocean is, the humble as the proudest sail doth bear, my saucy bark, inferior far to his, on your broad main doth wilfully appear. Your shallowest help will hold me up afloat, whilst he upon your soundless deep doth ride. Or being wrecked, I am a worthless boat. He of tall building and of goodly pride. Then, if he thrive and I be cast away, the worst was this, my love was my decay. Now, I do not suggest or recommend you recite this poem in this way when you recite it to your friends, nor do I give you permission to extract this as a clip and say to people, this is how this podcast Sebastian Michael recites his poems. I was trying to make an illustrative point. What is especially fascinating, apart from this mild mockery, though, is that it comes paired with the innuendo. This is subtle enough. If you were cautiously inclined, you would be right to counsel none of this actually talks about sex. But then, of course, none would. First of all, because in Shakespeare's day you just don't directly, in plain language, speak about sex. Secondly, because, as we saw when discussing the previous sonnet, Sonnet 79, William Shakespeare here is in a precarious situation as it is. The last thing he needs right now is a scandalous sensation. But once or twice before has it occurred to us that when Shakespeare does something out of the ordinary to his style, he may have something out of the ordinary to say in his contents. This makes sense. If you are a poet in the world that Shakespeare inhabits, you may occasionally want or need to say something that cannot be openly expressed. How do you alert your reader or listener that they should start looking and listening between the lines? Changing the form of address, heightening the level of style, introducing humour, or here, as it seems to be, a just slightly snarky sarcasm will certainly serve. There's an additional element that's worthy of note, and it ties in entirely with what we have observed so far. This sonnet, much more than the previous two, introduces a note of disapproval, so as not to say accusation, of the young man himself. Sonnet 78 and 79 did not do so. They contented themselves with observing what has been happening and, in the case of Sonnet 78, asking of the young man to value Shakespeare's offering more than that of others and, in the case of Sonnet 79, advising the young man not to overestimate this rival poet for what he has to offer. This sonnet here sails close to the wind by nearly disparaging the young man. It's not entirely obvious, but once you hear it, it's quite hard to unhear. But since your worth, wide as the ocean is, the humble as the proudest sail doth bear, my saucy bark, inferior far to his, on your broad main doth wilfully appear. Your shallowest help will hold me up afloat, whilst he upon your soundless deep doth ride. This superficially sounds like praise. Your worth is wide as the ocean, and this metaphorical sea is therefore capable of carrying both my humble little boat and his proud sail. But then you take into consideration that Will is being sarcastic. He doesn't really think that his saucy bark is far inferior to the other poet's grandiloquent declamations. He does not really believe that this other poet is a better spirit, and thus the praise turns faint. My saucy bark is the truth that I speak, and the genuine love and devotion that I have and express for you. But your sense of self, what today we would call your ego, is so huge that you need some pompous git pouring out his full of himself splurges of flattery for you, probably, so this sonnet certainly implies, receiving ample compensation for it, while on top of it all being allowed to ride upon your soundless deep. Whatever we want to mean or mean to want by that phrase in this instance. It is not something that, to use a verb Shakespeare coins early on in the collection, happies him, and for good reason, which would explain why he closes this poem on such a sober, newly sincere, and, after all, really rather resigned note. We are here, with all this, I concede, on quite shaky ground, and there is no pun intended here. This reading of a sexual component into the relationship between now not only Shaky himself and his young lover, forgive me, I couldn't resist it, but also between the young lover and this rival poet is conjecture. The words aren't, but our interpretation of them is. We will need what Shakespeare has touchstone in, as you like it, call a better instance. Indeed, as he betters this by worsening the grammar, a more sounder instance. And that Shakespeare himself shall provide. Not immediately. Sonnet 81 either reverts or detours to or via a more familiar, although in this case, it has to be said, most oddly metaphored promise of immortality for the young man through the power of poetry, and sonnets 82 through 85 steer well clear of anything that could be read as innuendo. But the last one of these rival poet sonnets, sonnet 86, finishes on a flourish that may just be genius, because there, bundled into an innocuous-seeming couplet at the end, we find an entendre that is at least double, if not triple, and that serves well to explain just why our poet is so upset by the arrival on the scene of this rival poet. Remember, you can find these sonnets together with a transcript of the podcast at sonnetcast.com. There's a contact form there should you wish to get in touch. There are details there of the first, I believe, ever half sonnethon, or certainly one of the first times ever this has been done. I will be reciting the first 77 of William Shakespeare's sonnets by heart at a live event in London, which we will webcast. We'll also record it, of course, and then put it online as a recording. The details of it are online. Please look them up, and please, if you can, donate to Arts for Dementia, the charity that will benefit from this undertaking and challenge. I thank you for this very much from the bottom of my heart, and please, of course, do join me again here on Sonnetcast, where we recite, reveal, and relive the sonnets of William Shakespeare.